Good afternoon and welcome to our session. My name is Craig Pittman. I'm a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times, and I've written a couple of books, Paving Paradise and Manatee Insanity. We had some technical difficulties. I was going to show you some fun pictures and so forth, but instead I'll have to just content myself with doing this. Welcome to Busting the Bad Guys. So that's my CSI Miami impression. It's entirely appropriate that we're discussing the law enforcement angle of environmental crimes in this particular setting. In 1905, a game warden named Guy Bradley was killed in the Everglades attempting to stop poachers who were killing birds, wiping out entire rookeries of egrets, roseate spoonbills, herons, for their feathers, because that was the fashion back then for ladies' hats. And so he was attempting to stop poachers from wiping out the rookeries in the Everglades and paid for it with his life. Things have changed somewhat in the law enforcement field for environmental crimes since then. In the 1970s, Congress passed a whole raft of new environmental laws, The folks in charge of enforcing them have faced somewhat different challenges from the ones that Guy Bradley faced. We have the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, et cetera. Probably the most dramatic, the biggest environmental crime of this century is the one that occurred this past year, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And that, of course, has now led to just recently the Department of Justice issuing a notice of violation to the folks who are involved with the Deepwater Horizon spill. We'll see how that plays out. But in the meantime, I hope you'll welcome our panelists. We have a very exciting and interesting panel today. Starting on my left here, Luis Santiago, who is the agent in charge for the Southeast region based in Atlanta of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Laurel Neem, who has written a book called Wildlife Crimes. Right?
Animal investigation,
I'm sorry, which is about the forensic aspect of wildlife crimes. Mike Fisher, who's the deputy director of the EPA's Office of Criminal Enforcement in Washington. And Jerry Phillips, who is with the Florida Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. So thanks very much for coming. And I'm going to start off by letting them make some short opening comments, and then we'll get into the discussion.
Okay.
All right, so I need someone to turn on the projector, because Luis is the only one of us who managed to get a PowerPoint.
Well, we're working on the other ones, but hopefully we'll get it. So,
Jerry, you broke it.
The light is not on.
While that thing gets warmed up,
you have handouts, and I also have a presentation on the handout, so if it doesn't come up, I mean, we can kickstart it that way. This is jam-packed with information about the Office of Law Enforcement and the work that we do. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about with some of the cases that we have working on, and also a little bit about our organization. So if the projector doesn't cooperate, you have a printout of the PowerPoint presentation. It's on the handouts. And in the handouts also you have a very handy information sheet about law enforcement at a glance. In this one-pager, you have an overview of our Office of Law Enforcement, what our mission is, how we're organized in terms of fighting wildlife crimes. And here it comes. It's warming up. I'm not going to have a lot of time to go in detail on our organization and stuff. So when you review this, there's very jam-packed information about our designated ports of entry, where we conduct import-export activity, also special ports and non-designated ports of wildlife, where we have our wildlife inspectors, and it has a good summary of the activity level of imports through those ports of entry, the top 9 or top 10 ports in terms of the number of shipments coming in through the United States. And in the Southeast region, we have 3 of the of those busiest ports, and also have a summary of the investigations and broken down by the caseload, and additional information about the annual summary of penalties from all our investigations for the past 3 years, giving you a snapshot of the fines, the prison times, and the probation and civil penalties that we have assessed. So a pretty neat handout. Has also a link to our National Forensics Lab that you can go online and get some additional information on that, and also the National Wildlife Repository and the the Eagle Repository as well. And I have some pictures that to go into some of that, those subjects. So, okay. So anyway, the mission statement, we enforce a number of wildlife statutes and conduct investigations, facilitate the wildlife trade, and concentrate on also field investigations on contaminants, hunting type regulations, habitat destruction, endangered species type cases, and I'll have some features in this presentation. Within the handouts, you have also a summary of all the laws and treaties that we enforce. This is all of those statutes, and then some additional statutes of violations that are not related to conservation, but we come into conspiracy, smuggling, and all those type of other federal statutes. We also charge those type of violations through our investigations, depending on each particular case. So the format of that brochure for each one of those statutes, you have the act, actually the purpose of the act, where the statute is found, the prohibitions for each of those laws, the penalties on that particular law, and then culpability, scienter, forfeiture and rewards provisions if it's provided on the actual act. So it's a very neat summary that has all that information. So if you're curious about what kind of prohibitions are in a particular law, you can go there straight and get that information. We have about 220 special agents. They are our plainclothes criminal investigators conducting field investigations. We also have special agents stationed at ports of entry that also conduct import-export type cases. The next thing, we have wildlife inspectors and wildlife inspectors assistants. Other positions that we have within the Office of Law Enforcement are evidence custodians and then our administrative staff. The uniform, the wildlife inspectors are our uniform officers that are stationed at the main ports of entry. Deal with all the compliance with the laws and regulations for import-export. They're the forefront defense, looking at shipments, finding, making sure that what is imported is, is actually what was allowed, basically doing compliance and smuggling interdiction. One of the cases that we recently worked, and some of you are probably familiar, was here in South Florida. It was 3 different cases that were kind of meshed together, and it was a joint operation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, and the National Park Service. And it dealt with the take of harvesting, the illegal harvest of lobsters, the illegal fisheries. And it was a very interesting case because the practice that was in place was eventually going to wipe out the Caribbean spiny lobster population because they were building these artificial habitats and placing them all over the Keys, on the west side of the Keys, interrupting the migration pattern of the lobsters, and they were collecting this outside of season, preventing the lobsters to go to the breeding ground, and that, you know, kind of circumventing the whole purpose of having open seasons, closed seasons, so they can ensure the reproduction of the population. Well, they were wiping this out every year after year without waiting for the open season and without allowing the migration to take place. We got some information and got involved in this case. It was very interesting. We used a slew of investigative techniques to get into this case. Some of the illegal harvesting methods was the out of season, over the limit, undersized, taking from other people's traps. And then the use of artificial habitat was the most damaging also on this operation. This is some pictures of what that casitas, they call it, that artificial habitat. They built this out of construction material, stuff from landfills, street signs. I mean, whatever they could find, they built these things, and the lobster would kind of shelter over there, and they would already have this saved on GPS tracking, and they would know where to go and to do their collections. So they litter the bottom floors all over the Keys, and you'll see in a couple of pictures here the magnitude of the problem of the these artificial habitats. You see some street signs that they use for also artificial habitat, and creating a terrible impact on the environment, because this was also destroying the seagrass beds and everything in the Keys. So a lot of garbage being dumped to create these things. This was taking place all in National Marine Sanctuaries, National Park Service areas, and wildlife refuges, federal wildlife refuges. And we have several tracking coordinates of where they were conducting these activities, and the routes that their boats were using. We were able to obtain some good information through informants and specialized equipment. And you see the tracking of the boat routes and where all this was spread out. I mean, we were hundreds and hundreds of these things all over the place. You have a summary of the penalties on these three investigations. I'm not going to go into details on who got what. I mean, it's eight defendants and felony convictions. Pretty good summary that you can read and see what was the outcome of these three cases. So you have that information available. This is one of the freezers, multiple freezers in one of the subject's residence. When we did the takedown, this is one of the residents, 1,700 pounds of lobster. This was a day one of open season, so they already have harvested all this. This is a second defendant residence, another 1,000 pounds on day one of the open season. So they didn't leave anything for anybody else. So retail value about $85,000 for this particular search warrant, and just a lot of lobster illegally taken. You know, different size, different out of season, no over the limits. I mean, they were just out to take everything that they could take. We ended up confiscating all their equipment. We got three boats, three trucks. He's selling his one of his residents in the Keys to pay for restoration. So all that information, you have it on the results of that case. Snake on a plane. This was here in Miami. This method, I mean, we have not seen this since 9/11, because after 9/11 and all the screening, It's very difficult to get anything passed by security. This was somebody was trying to smuggle these designer snakes and some tortoises, and he had it in his pants, actually. And we haven't seen this, I mean, since 9/11. He probably didn't get the memo. I don't know what he was thinking, that he was going to be able to pull that off. This case is still under investigation, so I don't have any results for that. Another investigation that we are currently wrapping up is Operation Black Gold. This pertains to a black coral trade. It was a black coral manufacturing company in the Virgin Islands with also operations and connections in Las Vegas. Came also through a cooperative effort with NOAA and our agents and CBP and ICE in St. Thomas, came across this plastic ornaments or artifacts box, and it contained all sorts of black coral on it. So when they X-rayed it, that doesn't look like plastic ornaments. And in this particular case, we already have some. It was endangered species. It's CITES Appendix 2. So and also a Lacey Act violation for false labeling. Ivan Chu was the main subject of this investigation. I think he's still serving those 30 months in prison, $12,500 fine, and supervised release. His wife got 20 months in prison and same amount of fine. And then Gem Manufacturing is an associate of him with operation in Las Vegas. Last week we were moving all that seizure into a warehouse. They just signed a plea agreement that we're going to have a sentencing next week, but they agreed to $1.8 to $2.2 million penalty. That's to be determined by the court, but it's going to be within that range. And community service payments of $500,000 and the forfeiture of all the products, jewelry and sculptures made out of black coral with a value of $1.4 million. Forfeiture of all the black coral with a value of over, around $1 million. 3 to 4 years probation after that. And then Ashu Bhandari is the CEO of that gem manufacturing company that the plea negotiations is going on right now. And last, a piano ivory importation, also another case of import-export type. That we dealt also. A lot of information. If you have any questions, now when we go to the Q&As, be happy to answer.
Can someone turn that off again? Thanks. I have to tell you, my favorite Miami Fish and Wildlife Service investigation story is the one where an official from Mexico was attempting to buy a gorilla illegally, and so a Wildlife Service agent actually dressed up as a gorilla to carry out the transaction. And he said the gentleman freaked out completely when he took the mask off. Anyway, Laurel can tell us about some of the more technical aspects of wildlife investigations and how things have been going with that. So, Laurel?
As Craig said, I wrote a book called Animal Investigators, which is like a CSI for wildlife, which basically shows how wildlife forensic science has really changed the face of wildlife law enforcement. And, killing wild animals is a huge, huge business. Just in the past few months, you heard a little bit about some cases right here in Southeast Asia, but it's really massive. I mean, here in Southeast Florida. In the Southeast region, but just in the past few months, Malaysian Customs has seized 1,800 elephant tusks from Africa, and on the Tanzanian side, they seized over 1,000 tusks in one shipment from Tanzania heading to Malaysia. That's one country, just a couple months, 2,800 tusks. And that doesn't even include Kenya Wildlife Service had similar types of seizures. It just goes on and on. And it's not just elephants. The number and diversity of illegal wildlife products is huge. It includes everything from exotic pets, live primates, birds, reptiles, to traditional Asian medicines with parts of rare species, art, high fashion accessories, and thousands of species, thousands of animals affected. And the reason for the trade's prevalence is really simple. Money. You saw a little bit there with the black coral about how high the value is. And, you know, the penalties might seem high, but compared to the value of the products being traded, it's really the cost of doing business. Plus, the places where they work tend to be remote areas, wilderness areas. There's a limited number of enforcement officers. You heard some numbers. I'll talk about that in a second, the 221. Well, that's to police, you know, 300 million people in the U.S., so it's a tiny number. And by comparison, I just want to throw out more of the profits. Profits are astronomical, up to 1,000% or more. I've done a lot of calculations on a lot of these cases, and compared to the investment time, you know, money, boats, gas, whatever, it's like 1,000% return on your investment. There's another problem for wildlife law enforcement, and that's often proving that a crime even occurred. With the spiny lobsters, you know it's a lobster and you know what the laws are and whatnot, but once an animal leaves the hands for a lot of the products, it really gets sliced and diced and processed into something that looks absolutely nothing like the animal it came from. And before an agent can establish that a crime even occurred, he or she has to start by proving what the victim is. And that's important because some species are protected and others are not. So, for example, a wool shawl from cashmere goats would be perfectly legal, but one from Tibetan antelope, which had to kill 5 antelopes, rare antelopes, is not. $20,000, by the way, one shawl. So, and so suspects know that. When they get caught, they say, oh, it's not, you know, elephant ivory, it's cow bone. And unless you can prove otherwise, there's nothing you can really do except with a couple products like rhino horn and tigers, because the law allows for just claims. But science changes that, because it can identify the species from the part. So for bear gallbladders, for instance, there are unique levels of 3 distinct bile acids. And those 3 bile acids will show up no matter the form. It can be a raw gallbladder, it can be frozen, dried, it can be crystallized powder, it can be in medicine. There was one case where it was in whiskey. So there was one chocolate, heard of pot brownies, well, now bear bile brownies. Anyway, but so it's seriously true.
We did not have samples, I'm sorry.
No, but it's remarkably effective. And in 98% of the cases of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensic Lab, the suspects plead out. They only testify in 2% of cases, which is pretty remarkable. And what's interesting is that the forensics can also change how law enforcement works by identifying criminal patterns and answering new legal questions as they occur. And sometimes that means still figuring out the what is it, you know, identifying the species for newly protected species, like you'll probably see with sharks. Another is the where did it come from question, when some species of particular geographic origins are protected and others are not. You saw this with these one-off sales of elephant ivory from certain African stockpiles in southern Africa while the eastern African populations were still protected. The where did it come from question comes across also with pet birds and the captive bird trade, captive versus wild-caught birds. And because captive bred is legal and wild-caught is not, and just as an aside, I hope we'll talk about some of the legal loopholes in some of the laws. So
yes, we'll get to that. Our next speaker is Mike Fisher from the EPA, who, rather than dealing with wildlife crimes, deals more with the things that tend to affect human health.
Right. Thanks, Greg, and hello, everyone. I've rather than wrestle with a PowerPoint, there's a short handout back there. I just did kind of a who, what, when, where, why thing about EPA's criminal enforcement program. So I'll walk through that in a couple minutes and save the rest of the time for questions. A few other handouts we've got back there. A less glossy ripoff of Luis's version of the Fish and Wildlife Cops. We've got a two-pager there, give you information about EPA's criminal enforcement program and a brochure. Finally, on the back table, there's a email sign-up sheet. And so if you'd like an electronic version of this PowerPoint presentation, or I was hoping we'd have about a, we'd get through our public affairs office, about a 40-page kind of explanation of EPA's criminal enforcement work. It has a lot of case examples, 14 or 15 kind of landmark cases from the last decade or so. It's not quite ready for prime time. You can see the table of contents back there and my last few line edits of the first page. But if you'd like a copy of that, please throw your email address on that sheet and we'll send you one middle of next week. So with that intro about handouts, the who of EPA's criminal enforcement program and of criminal pollution enforcement is similar to Fish and Wildlife in one respect. We're a small part of a much larger organization. EPA's got 17, 18,000 employees all together around the country. About 20% of those folks do enforcement generally, 3,400 or so. But the vast bulk of those do civil enforcement, and about 10% of EPA's enforcement personnel are in my shop. And it's a multidisciplinary group of folks, again, similar to the wildlife arena. We've got detectives, plainclothes law enforcement officers. They've got full federal law enforcement authority. They carry firearms. They can execute warrants. They can arrest people for any offense against the United States. They work in conjunction with a group of scientists at our forensics facility out in Colorado that do the pollution-related analytical work that's analogous to what Laurel was talking about in terms of wildlife analysis. And then there's a small group of attorneys at headquarters that I supervise, and then a group of about 30 EPA attorneys around the country in field offices that work with the special agents to develop investigations. And when they get to the point where prosecutors become involved in the matter, those attorneys also kind of orient the prosecutors to the nuts and bolts of the environmental laws that are at issue. And that's the last kind of piece of the who I thought I'd throw out just for your initial orientation. You know, we're the cop part of the criminal justice community here, and then there's the prosecutors. So for Luis's folks and mine, the Department of Justice prosecutes our cases. There's a small group of prosecutors in Washington, D.C., at Department of Justice headquarters, or Main Justice, as people call it, that are specialists in environmental crimes, and they fly around the country to prosecute these matters, but there are only about 40 of those folks. And so they can't get to all of our docket, which at any given time is probably 750 to 800 open criminal investigations. About 5 out of 6 of the cases that we investigate and turn into criminal prosecutions are done by U.S. attorney's offices around the country. So there are folks here in Miami, for example, who prosecute pollution crimes that our agents and forensic and attorneys have worked up. The what is probably fairly obvious. There's a slide in the handout that kind of ticks down the statutes in a way similar to what Luis explained to you all in the wildlife arena. And the long and short of that part of the story is that pretty much all of the pollution control statutes that EPA administers have criminal enforcement provisions. And so the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Hazardous Waste Statute, which is RCRA, and the Safe Drinking Water Act and a handful of others, all provide criminal penalties for folks, mostly folks who knowingly violate those statutes. What that means essentially is people who are engaged in purposeful, conscious conduct that violates the requirement of the statute. So we've all heard the old saw that ignorance of the law is no excuse, and that is true in environmental crimes as well. And so we don't have to show that people kind of cackled and twirled their mustaches and said, let's violate the Clean Water Act today. We don't have to show that they knew their conduct was illegal. But if we can prove that they intentionally discharge pollutants from a point source into water in the United States, or that they, you know, intentionally bypass their air pollution control device and let that stuff go, then we've shown that they've knowingly violated the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act, and those are both felony offenses. We also, I mentioned that our special agents have kind of across-the-board federal law enforcement authority. In the majority of our cases, we are also investigating kind of general, called Title 18 federal crimes, conspiracy, false statements, obstruction of justice, mail fraud, wire fraud. That kind of activity frequently accompanies pollution-related environmental crimes, and so that's part of our investigative docket. We've got a kind of a slide that gives you a sense of our life cycle of our work, our investigative pipeline. It starts very broad. We intake about 1,500 leads every year among the case agents that are out there working in the field. They winnow those down, kind of setting aside about 80% of those and referring those to civil enforcement at EPA or more likely to state agencies, sometimes local agencies, for civil enforcement attention or maybe state or local criminal attention. We open 300-ish, maybe 350 new investigations a year. And then that gets winnowed down further into charged cases. And there's a slide that gives you a sense of how many defendants we've charged and cases, investigations we've opened in each of the last 4 or 5 fiscal years. That's also on the back of this handout if you're interested in kind of data and outputs. Who, what, when, where is a map that shows you kind of how we're spread across the country. We have about 40 different offices where we have special agents, and they are in all of EPA's 10 regional offices. Where there's a special agent in charge, supervisory person in the field, like Zach Santiago. I'll refer to him formally for purposes of that point. But we also have about 30 other smaller offices with between 2 and 5 special agents, like here in Miami. And we kind of spread those folks far and wide so they can quickly respond to leads and get out and do the field work that's necessary to develop cases. And the why of the work, we can save till questions, or you can look at the slides back there. As Craig said, it's protection of human health and the environment, and ultimately, because of the size of our law enforcement organization, the fact that we've got, you know, 200 agents, you often hear in the media, and many of you may have written stories about the environmental cop on the beat. But we are not beat cops. You know, 200 special agents, that's about the size of the police force of Boca Raton. We are a detective squad is maybe a better analogy. And so in order to kind of provide maximum environmental protection, we have to do a really good job of selecting good investigations, investigating the heck out of those offenses, and then publicizing the effects of the prosecutions in order to deter people. To scare them straight. Most folks in regulated industry are, like most folks in this room and everywhere else, are law-abiding people who want to do the right thing. But in pollution control matters, as in everything else, there are a few folks who are risk-takers, and because of the large amounts of money that are involved, they are willing to skate close to the line and go back and forth across it and hope that they won't get caught. And sometimes there are players in both regulated industry and the pollution control service world that are just outright outlaws. And so finding those folks, prosecuting them, and publicizing the effects of those prosecutions is critical for us to generate the deterrence that we need to have to prevent other violations and protect human health and the environment. So I'd encourage you to look at those stories. They are great stories to tell, great coverage in every one of our major prosecutions. So with that, I'll stop. Thanks.
Thank you. And now for a completely different perspective, Jerry Phillips from the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, an organization that sometimes, at least internally, likes to regard itself as the turd in the punch bowl. Did I build you up too much, Jerry?
I was going to kind of color it up a little
Okay.
bit, maybe dress it up. My name is Jerry Phillips. I'm the director of the Florida chapter of the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Basically, we are the burr in the saddle. We're kind of the burr in the saddle of many of the agencies, state and federal. Our membership is overwhelmingly public employees, who most of whom are career public employees who, our experience has been, they simply want to be able to do their jobs. And they can contact us anonymously and tell us, look, this is what I am facing in my office. This is what you guys need to look at. Somebody needs to look at. Some of them, unfortunately, want to become whistleblowers, and we do everything that we possibly can outside of just bound and gagging them to prevent them from becoming whistleblowers, because anybody who's done that understands it's a very lonely existence and usually career killing to boot. But that's kind of where we come from. And I'm an attorney. I used to work for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in their general counsel's office. And actually, with Florida, I don't deal that much with EPA or Fish and Wildlife, simply because most of the so-called big-name federal environmental statutes, administration of those statutes has been delegated to the state agencies. So consequently, we deal most often with the state. Now, one of the things that we hear from employees, though, both state and federal, frankly, right now they're scared to death. The political climate is one in which they do not know, I think it's safe to say, at federal or state level. They don't have a lot of job security. I saw just this week there was a proposal put out by, Paul Ryan, I believe, or Ron Paul, excuse me, wants to eliminate or cut the EPA budget by 30%. And that actually may be more than one of the more moderate positions. So that does not engender a lot of job security. And that's a very real problem. And if you talk to the public, what we've found is most of the public tells us, we want to do away with these regulations. And then you say, well, do you want clean water? And they overwhelmingly, absolutely, we want clean water. What about clean air? Yeah, I want my kids not to develop asthma. But they don't want the regulations. They think they don't want the regulations that would serve that protection. With respect to criminal enforcement, particularly in the state system, I was telling Mike, you know, one of the problems we have in Florida is, and having worked in this at DEP, one of the things that we found, and I don't know how many folks here are from Florida, but if the DEP, for example, determines that they have a case that needs to go criminal, they have to farm that case out. They have to find a local state attorney or assistant state attorney to prosecute it. And I've been, too many times I've been on the side of having to find that assistant state attorney. And usually, the minute you mention environmental, the eyes glaze over. And heaven help you if you see, say, Clean Water Act or RCRA or something like this. They do not understand it. They're used to prosecuting burglaries and robberies and so forth. And they don't think they can sell it to a jury. That has a necessarily chilling effect on criminal enforced law enforcement of these environmental crimes in Florida. But that said, the state does prosecute cases, as does EPA and the federal and Fish and Wildlife. But one of the things that I frankly see is I guess we're more antagonistic. We would like to see the agencies, frankly beat the drum publicly for more and stricter enforcement. In other words, educate the public so the public understands exactly what is at stake here. EPA, to its credit, I mean, you guys, you do, I'm just looking through your site, you all really do this on the federal level. When you look at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, however, there was to date, in 2011, they have publicized they issued one press release for environmental charges being brought in 2011, one case. And that was a RICO case brought against an individual for fraudulently trying to sell mold remediation, which should have been brought, but there's an awful lot of other stuff out there. In 2010, in the entire year, there were eight cases. Those cases were largely littering cases or waste tire cases. There was one mangrove alteration case, which is a big problem in South Florida, and yet the cases aren't being prosecuted. And those are the ones they're highlighting. So believe me, if they have the really big cases, they're not going to be quiet about it. So they're just not doing it, in other words. That, in a nutshell, is kind of what we're looking at. We take this information from employees. Sometimes we contact the agencies and say, hey, what can you do to resolve this? I'll save the rest for Q&A.
Thanks. We're going to move into the Q&A section now, but I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative to ask the first question. Can you tell us anything about what's going on with the oil spill investigation?
Well, since the Attorney General announced soon after the spill that a criminal investigation has been opened, I can tell you that. But otherwise, no.
Okay.
Next
All
question.
Right. All right. The format for this is SEJ members get to ask questions first and then other folks. So do we have any SEJ members who would like to ask a question? Yes, ma'am.
I'm Patricia Sackett, student. I was wondering, Mr. Santiago, you were talking about the black gold coral. How significant is the coral problem as it relates to the home design industry?
Right? As it relates to what?
The home design, people that trade in corals for the home design industry.
And repeat the question back, too, because some folks may not have heard it all.
Yeah, this is in terms of the black coral case.
It might be black coral, but I know that in some situations there's been coral that has been confiscated that came from other parts. It came for the home design industry.
Okay, on how that relates to the home design industry.
Is that significant?
Not really. I'm not aware of any connection with the home design industry. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you. Yeah. Do you guys make case? I know you're able to make cases against people who are actually involved in the illegal take of these species.
Yes.
What about the recipients, the folks who are the receivers of this property? Is there any chance of prosecuting them and discouraging?
Sort of the
dealing in stolen property.
The clients buying this.
Yes.
The issue with CITES Appendix 2, which is where the coral classification falls under, there's legal ways to do this type of operation. There's legal ways to import the black coral. There's the regulations provide for permits for these purposes, and you can find legal items throughout the market, but it got to go in compliance with the rules and regulations. This was, basically a smuggling operation, harvesting corals illegally, coming into the U.S. for the purpose of manufacturing.
Yes.
Joanne Plenty. I want to follow up on the question that I think Craig just addressed you, and I don't think I heard the answer. What can you do about the couple of restaurants in Key West that were receiving the spiny lobster? I mean, what happens to those restaurant jobs?
There's follow-up investigations that kind of get generated from the initial case, and there's additional work that we do as we identify other defendants, and we generate some additional cases. We're currently working on some of those follow-ups investigations.
Are there any examples you could give us of other cases where you were able to make that case against not just the person who was dealing with the smuggling, but the ultimate recipient?
I kind of think of one right now, but if we get information that, let's say through an investigation, we do search warrants, we inspect records, if we uncover links to other operations locally, we go and investigate those as well. And it can generate a total different case that will, you know, get prosecuted, presented to a U.S. attorney for possible prosecution.
Interesting. Oh, I was just going to add, as an example, the Operation McCall, which was done out of Ohio, which involved trafficking of Brazilian Amazon Indian feather art. And that case, I mean, you had the suppliers. It also launched an investigation related to the suppliers in Brazil, and that was a huge case there. But as far as the purchasers of those products, there were about 20 different buyers that were sort of, there were lots more than 20 buyers of that art, but the Fish and Wildlife Service took sort of the top 20, which was over $10,000 in purchases for each buyer, and then they charged 10 of them under civil penalties, though, and they all forfeited their material and then paid a fine, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 fine. But it led to another case, and there was a buyer, again, which was former Smithsonian Secretary Lawrence Small.
I read about that one, yes.
And he had a collection worth about, the purchases that were involved in the case were like $400,000, but his collection was over $1 million.
Was he prosecuted?
He had to forfeit his collection and then do community service, which he tried to do to change the law that was...
His community service was to try to lobby to change the law that
right,
he was convicted
of? Right, because he had a lot of contacts and worked a lot related to that law. But right. Anyway, so
yes.
Just as specific
yes.
examples.
Yes.
I guess just to follow up on that, I mean, unless you have a strict liability statute that doesn't require the government to prove mens rea, and there are some of those in the wildlife context.
You may want to say what mens rea is.
The criminal intent.
Yes.
Right? We don't have any strict liability statutes on the pollution control side except for a 19th century Rivers and Harbors Act statute that's seldom used. So for us, and for a lot of wildlife cases relating to contraband items, right, you don't know whether the buyer of that stuff is a victim or part of a criminal conspiracy at first, obviously. And in the PowerPoint handouts, the last one is a series of South Florida refrigerant smuggling cases we've investigated, and they've been prosecuted down here. So, you know, these are ozone-depleting substances, right? We're now into the second generation of these. CFCs are, for the most part, illegal and gone. HCFCs are now being used, but they're heavily restricted, and people smuggle them into the country and sell them. So in that series of investigations, we prosecuted a distributor because we could prove they knew they were getting smuggled material and trafficking it. But plenty of folks buy stuff after being defrauded and thinking it's legit, and then they are subject to forfeiture and losing the stuff and maybe civil penalties, but they're not necessarily criminals.
Interesting point.
Craig,
I'm sorry.
I would like to add, I mean, a case that came to mind, we're discussing this. We worked a Queen Kong case a few years back where it was an international case. A lot of our cases are, international in scope. And this Queen Kong was being harvested illegally in the Caribbean. There was a ban in place, so it was a complex scheme developed to ship these items into Colombia, go and then from Colombia we ship to Canada, generate permits that would mask the origin of the conch meat, and eventually ended up in South Florida. So it was a big, complicated case. We worked with Canadian authorities, and we ended up confiscating thousands of pounds of the queen conch that was being harvested illegally, and identified the players in the United States and here in South Florida that were also involved in this operation, about basically orchestrating this whole operation, and with criminal penalties, jail times, and that's kind of another typical type case where we identify the source here and, you know, present it for our prosecution.
Yes?
Rob Davis, a reporter with Voice of San Diego. Luis, in the Piano Corporation case that you cited, it was the penalty was 3 years probation. And so I'm just kind of curious sort of where the hammer is when you catch these sort of needle in a haystack cases. If the ultimate penalty is, you know, along the lines of a second DUI?
Well, it all depends on the circumstances of the case. This particular case, I think, you know, it was first-time offense. It's a CITES violation. It was also a smuggling type case because, I mean, the way this case generated was the actual company contacted the service to inquire about the import regulations for ivory. And just through the course of the back and forth with the company, kind of raised a flag. And we kind of key on the company, and when the shipments for this company start coming in, we start, you know, paying closer attention to it. Went and did the inspection of the shipment for pianos. Basically, what they did was they removed the keys of the piano, wrap them up, and put it within the shipment. And we were able to, through inspection, come across that. It's probation is still a penalty on their records. If this happened again with this company, there are going to be more severe penalties assessed.
Let me just mention one thing. My next book is called The Scent of Scandal, and it's about an orchid smuggling case that occurred here in Florida. And the prosecutor in that case, who her job, she's based in Washington, and she works for the Department of Justice prosecuting environmental crimes around the country, and she said that her biggest challenge is getting judges to take the crime seriously, because they look at them and go, oh, well, this is just a flower. Oh, this is just something involving monkeys. You know, this is hardly like drug smuggling. And so a lot of the sentences do wind up being probationary sentences. Yes, in the back.
Hi, Chris Brennan, Columbia Journalism Review. My question jumps off from Mike's comment about not being able to comment about the criminal investigation. I know this is kind of a source of frustration for a lot of journalists, not just with the oil spill, but criminal investigations in general. So I guess I'm wondering, to what extent reporters can help out, in a sense, once a criminal investigation, maybe not in particular types of cases where the media can really play a role. Does it ever work out like it does in the movies where some traffic reporter helps you crack a case?
That happens all the time. Didn't you know that?
Go ahead. Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues wrapped up in that question. One thing that jumps to mind immediately is that we had a series of major prosecutions that are discussed both in this document, which is on the back table, and in that longer thing that we'll email folks at the end or middle of next week, the McQuain company, headquartered in Alabama, and we, the government, learned about their serious environmental violations from investigative journalism, from a joint project between Frontline and the New York Times. And those stories led to a series of prosecutions that resulted in the convictions of multiple corporate officers in different locations and many, many millions of dollars in criminal fines. So there are stories like that. But that's an exception, not the rule. And I guess what I would say is that the way to best address the issue from my perspective, as somebody, you know, working inside the criminal justice system, is not the way you sometimes see it on the cop show, where you've got a detective who's kind of slipping information to somebody who writes the story, but rather for you all and for us to explain when the process and what portions of the process are public information, right? So when a search warrant is executed at a facility, sometimes the government will seal that search warrant affidavit, but that's a minority of cases. Usually that search warrant affidavit is a public document. The grand jury process by law is secret, and folks who have access to grand jury information can be criminally prosecuted for revealing that information to a private citizen or a member of the press. But once charges are filed, again, unless those are under seal, which happens much more frequently in violent crime cases where people are worried about witness safety and so forth, once charges are filed, then that's totally public. And it is more often than not the case in our prosecutions that the DOJ prosecutors we work with file what's called a speaking indictment. It tells you more than just, you know, the government alleges that XYZ company committed this particular offense under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. It tells the story of the criminal conduct and then has the allegation at the end of that document. So there are places in the process, even before trial, for the media to engage and get access to public information. But we, and especially prosecutors, are always going to be concerned about preserving the defendant's ability to get a fair trial, right? And lawyers are subject, both at EPA and at DOJ, to ethics, bar ethics obligations that tell us things ought to be tried in courts and not in the press. So that is a, you know, very proper constraint on us. And defendants, criminal defendants who are facing trial, if they have had the story of their case told in the press, will frequently file motions claiming that they can't get a fair trial in this jurisdiction and it has to be moved somewhere else. That adds to the burden on prosecutors, which, you know, as you might imagine, are never coming to a big corporate criminal case with more resources than their opponents. They're always struggling to kind of get this thing postured in a way, tee it up for a successful prosecution. So it's a concern for prosecutors that defendants not be able to raise a bunch of really troubling claims about the potential for a tainted jury pool. But all that said, you know, we, for reasons I explained earlier, we need the public to understand what these prosecutions are about, and we need the regulated community to understand what these prosecutions are about to deter future misconduct. So I should have introduced him at the start, but in the back row, Jeff, you can raise your hand. Jeff McAtee is from our small public affairs shop within EPA's criminal enforcement program. He is not quite a majority of the whole operation, but he's close to it. I'd encourage you all to say hi to him afterwards, and we ought to be talking to each other about the public information that is available in these cases, because there is some.
If I could jump in there real quick on this. I'm a big fan of press pushing on these things, and some of it you just got to be a geek. You know, there are, for example, there are reports that are submitted quarterly to the EPA by the state agencies, and they're called QNCRs for quarterly noncompliance reports, or SNCC list, which is significant noncompliers, and these are reports that tell the EPA where the worst offenders are in their neck of the woods. And I have gotten many of these reports through FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and you would be astonished to see just how many facilities in, they're NPDS facilities, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System facilities. They discharge the surface waters under permit. And you'd be surprised how many of them, just in the state of Florida, are habitual, repeat offenders of their permits.
Jerry, could you mention the name of those reports again, so making sure everybody got
them? They're quarterly noncompliance reports. Those are just routine permit violations. And then for those polluters who are more habitual, they make it onto what we call the significant noncompliance list. The agencies call them QNCRs and SNCC list. But they're a wealth of information, and then you can from that you can submit further FOIA requests to get the inspection reports of those facilities and so forth. And in states like Florida, we have a very open public records law. This stuff, 90% of it's available to the public. All you got to do is ask. Now when I say that, it's time consuming, you know. But it gives you the ability to start looking into this stuff and then go to the agencies and say, what's happening with this facility? You know, there are facilities in North Florida, pulp and paper mills, who have been discharging for over a decade without current permits, simply because nobody pushes them.
If I can just follow up on that, Chris, you asked a question at this morning session about the administration's commitment to transparency, and I would say, you know, this is a good point about getting access to information, but I think now, this is not kind of my area of expertise at EPA, but I'm pretty sure that information is already available through EPA's internet site as a result of a recent expansion of compliance data's availability to the public as part of this administration's commitment to transparency. So there's no need to jump through the FOIA hoops anymore. You just get on the internet and there it is.
Is that the enforcement map that you guys use?
That enforcement map is kind of a way of displaying the results of enforcement actions. I'm talking about ECHO, which is a system of information about compliance status of different types of permitted facilities.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if I could share a story that's very colorful.
If it's quick.
I once met a guy who about 10 years ago, when I was living in Costa Rica, he was an American living there, and he had just served time for having smuggled monkeys and birds of paradise from Thailand into the U.S. on his way to Costa Rica. It became an international news story because he had smuggled baby monkeys down inside his pants.
Generally, any news story where you can insert "in his pants" in the lead, that's going to get a lot of attention. Yes?
I've read recently that most of the fish that we buy in grocery stores and in restaurants is not actually correctly labeled. That is something that's the FDA issued a report showing that a lot of that comes from places that are not well regulated about toxic chemicals and is, in fact, contaminated with that. Are you working in that area?
We don't have jurisdiction on that. That's probably a FDA issue, not Fish and Wildlife issue.
FDA is doing the testing for toxics, but someone's got to be regulating the fish.
Yeah. NOAA, National Marine Fisheries, is the main agency that regulates fisheries.
Yes, and make sure you identify yourself. I'm sorry, I haven't been strict about that. I should have been.
Ian Chant, a question for Laurel, mostly, I think. And some of the people I've talked to about this issue of smuggling illegal animals and the illegal wildlife trade, a lot of it seems to come down to people in these areas, especially in rural areas like you mentioned Brazil and the bird trade there, not really having any other way to make a living. And so how important is addressing like underlying economic situations in addressing the illegal wildlife trade?
So the question is about the people who are doing the poaching and the killing of the endangered species or the rare species and selling it, doing it because they have no other way of making a living. And that is the case in a lot of areas. And it's not the case in a lot of areas. And what's interesting is forensics, again, uncovered that it was not the case in things that you used to think it was the case. So for ivory trafficking, people used to think it was destitute farmers and, you know, rural people in Africa shooting elephants. They're raiding farms and whatnot, and so it helps protect the farms. And all very valid things that are happening. But what they found in examining these very large shipments of elephant ivory, DNA analysis suggested, they did comprehensive DNA analysis of two major shipments. There was 6.5 tons seized in Singapore and 3.9 tons confiscated in Hong Kong. And it showed that in each of those shipments, they had come from closely related elephants in very specific geographic regions. And what that showed was that instead of it being a trader collecting ivory from a lot of disparate sources. It was really organized networks financing killing of herds and basically filling purchase orders. So that, again, changes the face of where people, now you can start looking at those specific localities. It helps the agencies do more with less anti-poaching patrols on the routes and whatnot. And it's similarly, something similar like in India where, again, there was a recent study just released this month about DNA analysis of a bunch of different cases involving tiger bones and body parts, and it showed that it was from central Indian tiger reserves. And again, so with certain, especially with certain species, you end up with more organized networks instead of the one-off types of people. And the poor destitute, I'm not saying that that's not happening, but especially with ivory, you can, rhino, tigers, pangolin, there's a lot.
We have time for two more questions. Go ahead.
Just a follow-up. Maybe.
Don't forget to ID yourself.
Yeah, Rob, the Assistant Voice of San Diego. Looking for like the narratives in those inspection reports for reporters. Is there a place to go to find those? You know, Joe Smith was found up near Dioxin down the drain, as opposed to, you know, a tick next to...
So you know, you're asking, is there any special skill needed in reading the reports?
There's not a special skill, but usually what I see, for example, in Florida is you ask for the correspondence. You want to get the compliance, what they call the compliance and enforcement file. And you go to the correspondence, and in the correspondence, a lot of times you will see letters written from the agency to the polluter telling them that they've uncovered certain things. And that's one place to look. The other thing is just basic inspection reports. On federal permits, there are what we call compliance enforcement inspections, five-year inspections. Those will sometimes give you information.
Yes?
Do you ever have... I hear a lot about...
Don't forget to identify yourself.
Jonathan Olin from the Sierra Club, everybody's representative. I hear a lot about, you know, the poachers and trafficking and this and that. What about county and local governments in Florida? Does the U.S. EPA ever file criminal charges against them?
I don't know about Florida, but certainly governments can, you know, the federal government is the country's biggest polluter by a lot of different measures. And state and local governments are regulated by the pollution control statutes. And the bottom line, short answer to the question is yes. EPA has investigated and DOJ has prosecuted a number of state and local entities for different types of pollution control crimes. I saw outside a guy from the Chicago Tribune. I don't see him here, but there's a case under indictment right now in the Chicago area of a couple of individuals who worked for a city that was falsifying drinking water information and using water from a contaminated well to supply the citizens of the town. We've prosecuted both municipalities and county governments that operate sewage treatment plants. And in those circumstances, you know, that's another type of industrial activity, a public sector one, instead of the usual, you know, widget-making private sector one. But the dynamics are the same. You know, there are compliance costs there, and the operator has to shoulder those costs and do the right thing. And in some instances, state entities falsify information, discharge at night, and do the kind of things that lead to criminal prosecution. So the short answer is yes. There have been a number of cases of that sort, but they're far outweighed, as you might expect, by commercial private sector
would
prosecutions.
You file a suit, or prosecute another federal agency?
We can't. There's this notion of the unitary executive, and it essentially boils down to we can't prosecute ourselves. in the executive branch, but what we can do and what we have done in a number of cases is prosecute federal employees who have committed environmental crimes at some kind of federal facility, whether that's a DOD base or you know, another type of operation. So individuals within the federal government, either civilian or military, are subject to prosecution for environmental criminal conduct.
Can I just quickly? One real issue is the West Indian manatee in Florida, and we are now with we've actually sued the Fish and Wildlife to get rules promulgated for interaction with that species. One thing that may want to be investigated for anybody that's got the time is we have been told, may or may not be true, that state officials will ticket individuals for harassing manatees. But the game is that then when it comes to trial, they don't show up at the trial. The result is that the case is dismissed. So it looks good on the books that you've got all these tickets being issued, but in reality, nothing is being done. The problem is that the business community is highly opposed to this, to protecting the West Indian manatee. It's a serious problem in Florida right now.
And with that, I'm going to thank our speakers, Jerry Phillips, Mike Fisher, Laurel Neame, and Luis Santiago. Thanks very much for coming. And let me strongly urge you to head over to the ballroom where Sylvia Earle will be speaking at 3:30. Thanks again.